Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Weighing in with soybeans and the baby show straight out of Norbert, Missouri, we have Soybean Festival. From Hayward, Wisconsin, at 73 years young with the world's largest muskie statue, put it together for Muskie Fest. Finally, packing a punch with fire dancing and a pet costume contest, the Roseau, Minnesota Fall Harvest Fest. One of these festivals could win $100,000 in the Cenex Hometown Throwdown. You decide. Cast your vote at CenexHometownThrowdown.com. Cenex, powered locally.
It's my pleasure to welcome you here to the Clark Howard Show, where our mission is to serve you with advice and information that empowers you so you make better financial decisions in your life. And if you haven't subscribed to the daily Clark.com newsletter, I hope you will. You go to Clark.com/newsletter or newsletters and you sign up. They're totally free, but they are priceless. I learn something every day from my own Clark.com newsletter. It's so well researched. By the way, I got some crazy tax tips for you to share with you in the middle of tax season. Particularly, I got some advice for you about how Series I savings bonds that I kind of gave people whiplash saying, buy them, sell them. Want to tell you how those are taxed and what you need to know so you don't get penalties from the IRS. And then later in this podcast, I'm going to talk about what is it workers really want right now that employers seem to be tone deaf to. We're going to talk that through. So, yeah, our Team Clark Consumer Action Center pretty much has a new cuss word, I-bonds, because they're very confusing to people, and they're hard to explain, hard to understand. And I go through cycles going all the way back to the 1990s where I'd say, buy them now. Don't buy them anymore. Sell the ones you bought. All this because they are an amazingly complicated product designed to reward you where you don't lose purchasing power versus inflation, that they compensate you where with normal savings, you're over time going to fall behind inflation. The theory of Series I savings bond is you stay with inflation. But as I recently advised, people who bought them back when they were almost 10%, earning almost 10%, that weirdly, it makes sense to consider selling them now and then paying the tax and then rebuying Series I's because the new Series I's offer a better deal because they give you the rate of inflation plus an additional bonus amount of interest every year. So you're making more than the inflation rate on simple savings. But, okay, imagine this. This is just beyond stupid. The U.S. Treasury Department that runs the IRS, that runs the Series I savings bond program, doesn't send you a 1099 when you cash out a Series I savings bond. But then when you don't remember that you had interest on it and report it on your taxes, that same Department of the Treasury, through the IRS, taxes you and charges you penalties and interest, as well as the tax, for not having reported the income from the sold Series I savings bond. Because you don't have to pay the tax on what you've earned till you sell them, but then you got to report the tax. But then they don't send you anything saying, this is how much you earned, so report this. So listen to how crazy this is. You have to go onto your account with Treasury Direct, where you bought the Series I savings bonds, and you have to go click to find your tax document, print it out, and then have it to report with your taxes. And if you sold Series I savings bonds last year and you're like, oops, I didn't do that, go do it and report it, even if you have to just send the IRS some extra money to cover that tax, because every day you do it sooner, less interest and penalties that you'll owe. And by the way, there's something I learned in a Wall Street Journal story recently that I thought was really great. If you have an account with the IRS, you can go on there and you can see all the 1099s that you may have received from whoever, particularly if you do gig work. It's great because if you moved or whatever, the 1099s may not find you, but they found the IRS, and the IRS is going to find you for the tax. And then if you didn't report it, again, interest and penalties. So if you set up a personal account with the IRS, you can see them all each year as you're doing your taxes, print them out, and make sure you report everything.
I just got a nasty gram from the IRS.
Yeah, you got to tell us about what happened to you. I was going to get handcuffs and bring them today so we could cart you away in handcuffs. But
yeah,
tell us what kind of fraudster it turns out you are.
So somebody filed for unemployment and using my name, social security number, and address. They put the wrong phone number down in the state of California, where I don't live and have never lived. And I got a letter that I owed $17,000 in taxes on that. I think they got $27,000. I don't know what it was, but I have an accountant, thank goodness, who's helped file my taxes for years. And we got on the phone with California and with the IRS, and there's a lot we have to go through, but it was definitely identity theft. And what I said to the lady in California was, thank goodness I've had my credit frozen for so many years, because obviously somebody has like all my information. And she said, well, what we recommend is that you file a complaint with the FTC. I was like, but I think you should tell people to freeze their credit. So yeah, I've got to go through all of that now and file.
This is a perfect example about why you freeze your credit, because our information is out there, whether you know or not, or you became numb to all the data breach notices you get. Everything about us is in the hands of criminals, either already or will be. It's just a fact. So if Krista had not frozen her credit, it means that in addition to filing for unemployment as you and running off with $27,000 in taxpayer money, in addition to that, they would have been able to apply for credit as if they're you, buy a car as if they're you, maybe even take out a mortgage as if they were you.
My gosh.
And you'd be in a mess many times worse than cleaning this up.
Right. I know. I was so, so glad.
And the good news is you're not going to jail.
Let's hope not. Okay. We'll go to questions now. This one's from Jasper in Oregon. I've been asked by a friend to be the financial sponsor for their new wife from Croatia who is seeking citizenship. The chances of me actually needing to provide support are slim, as my friend is wealthy via her ex who lives in another country. However, unexpected turn of events can happen, and by signing, I could conceivably be responsible for someone I've never even met in person. More concerning is the amount of personal information I would have to provide to the law firm my friend has hired. Social security number, passport number, driver's license, every aspect of ID you can think of, enough to destroy me if identity theft occurs. Also required are complete financial records, tax returns, and every element of my financial picture, which I consider personal and private. I want to do my friend a solid, but as a longtime listener to Clark, contemplating what could go wrong here has led to shallow breathing and sleep disruption.
All right. So Jasper, all the financial and personal information you have to give is dovetailing right with what we were just talking about, creates a known risk in your life of identity theft. That part, don't lose sleep over. Just if you haven't done so, freeze your credit. That will prevent a lot of the abuses if this information fell into the wrong hands that could occur. The bigger issue is the first one you named, and it happens again and again and again. There will be someone who needs a sponsor for somebody and their relationship crumbles. That person vanishes into the ether of the United States. Then you're the one they come after on the financial guarantees. And so you are having to suffer enormous financial cost. So you got to be really confident, Jasper, that your friend will, in the event that things don't work out with the marriage, that your friend will be the one who ponies up whatever financial guarantee money. Because that's the risk, that what you're losing sleep over should not be identity theft. It should be the financial risk to you and what possibility, and you got to know your friend well enough, what possibility the friend would say, that was such a bad experience. I'm washing my hands of that. Gosh, sorry you got stuck with all those financial obligations.
Like medical bills, yeah. Other things. Yeah.
So you got to be really confident that your friend is going to come through if things went badly in an unexpected and costly way.
Paul in North Carolina says, we owe $25,000 on our car with a 2.5% rate. We have enough money in our Ally account to pay it off. Currently, our savings rate at Ally is 4.5%. Should we pay the car off? We have a 6-month emergency fund in place and are contributing 15% to retirement accounts.
So, Paul, congratulations on the last two things you said. 15% to retirement accounts, six months of emergency funds. That's outstanding. So paying off the loan, you got a 2-point spread there. You're arbitraging here. As long as savings rates are meaningfully higher, which they are in the example you gave, keep paying the car loan as agreed. You're a banker. You're earning 2% spread on your money, and you want to keep that up. There's no advantage to paying off the vehicle loan other than psychological. If you just hate having a loan, then you could sacrifice the earnings you're getting every month on that spread. But otherwise, keep both in place, the savings and the loan.
Michael in Ohio says, I recently talked to a dental office about having the dentist perform 3 tooth implants. Since I don't have dental insurance, I asked how much it would cost and if I could get a discount by paying cash instead of using a credit card and or having all 3 teeth done at the same time, like a quantity discount. I was told the dentist could not give discounts because it would be quote unquote insurance fraud. The dentist's assistant said they have contracts with insurance companies that prevent them from giving any discount to patients who do not have dental insurance coverage. I was astounded to hear it was insurance fraud to negotiate a lower price on dental services. In my mind, it sounded more like consumer fraud.
So that's wild, because even the American Dental Association has a write-up, because this came up a few years ago and I checked, they still say it, that dentists are free to offer you an upfront cash discount. And it is an accepted business practice in dentistry. I'm very surprised somebody, some point along the way, intimidated this dental practice into thinking that they could not offer discounts to cash payers. And that is an illegal restraint of trade. You know, if the dentist wants to offer a discount, I can't wait to hear somebody tell me that I'm wrong on this. And maybe we'll hear that. But I mean, even their trade association in the dentistry industry, the ADA, says that this is done. So
get a second opinion anyway. Yeah, it's always a good idea.
How did you know I was going to say that next? Yes. Go get another price quote elsewhere, because cash discounts are routine. And I hope that the dental repair work goes really well for you.
And you also recently talked about you should always get a second opinion on anything, like in terms of the medical part of it. So
exactly.
You never know.
So coming up ahead, here's a second opinion. What do workers actually want in the workplace? I've got a lot of new data, and it may not surprise you at all. As of late, more and more employers have decided enough of hybrid work. You're coming back, and you're coming back 5 days a week, or you're out of here. Yeah. Gosh, what a disconnect. As I said before, and got a lot of blowback, I think there's a generation gap between the ages of the typical corporate executive who wants to be able to see everybody eye to eye as they walk down the hall, and a workforce that is substantially younger than the average boss in the executive suite. So I saw a thing in the business journals, what additional cost employees now have who were working remotely and now have to come into the office, and this is just hard dollars, $561 a month in additional cost for that worker, commuting, clothing, whatever it is. And I know people who work in a job that you can only work on site are playing the world's smallest violin with the world's saddest song for people who were able to work remotely. That's a privilege you have not had if you're working in a job that you have to be there to do, manufacturing, assembly, service, restaurants, you name it. But there's a significant portion of Americans who were able to continue working, doing what they do where they wanted to be instead of in a physical office. Well, same Business Journal article found that the average worker who is now being required to come into an office instead of working remotely is willing to take a 13% pay cut just to be able to not commute. Now, it's a privilege to not commute, obviously. You're not putting miles on your vehicle. You're not taking a chance of being in a wreck, being on the roads. You have more time in your life not having to have the commute time. All these different things. But you also will suffer lack of raises and promotions that people that are physically in front of this older generation of bosses, they are old school and they identify only with people they see right in front of them. And those are the people who get the promotions. Those are the people who get the better raises. And I think even if it was not an age difference, humans are social animals. And there's a tendency to feel more affinity to people you're seeing in person than people you see on a screen. So both things are true. But one other thing to be aware of, employers have boosted pay by meaningful amounts in recent years because of marketplace pressures to attract and keep workers and because of the inflation that was so ugly in the economy for a couple of years and still not pretty, but not ugly anymore. Most workers fell behind. And the only way for those workers to catch up is to be disloyal, to be a job hopper. Because employers still are having trouble finding enough workers. I mean, latest survey data shows that the number one priority of almost half of employers is to find more workers, find new workers that are qualified for the jobs they're trying to hire for. So the marketplace provides an interesting set of pressures. One, employees who need more money to cover their expenses because their quality of living, their standard of living was ravaged by inflation. And the only way for them to get more money is to go somewhere else where they're valued more than where they are, because particularly the larger an organization is, the more they have these bureaucratic rules about, oh, well, this year's maximum pay increase is going to be 3.14% for our very top performers. And the average raise is going to be 2.7% and all that garbage. And then you can go outside and somebody may offer you 25% more going somewhere else. So there's a lot of factors going on right now in the job market. And if you feel like your employer is tone deaf to what you need, the opportunity is still out there. Think about this. Almost half of employers still looking desperately to hire people who have the talents and skills they're looking for. If you've got them, if you've got those talents, those skills, the training, experience that that employer is looking for, you can maybe move way up the pay scale and potentially have the working conditions you want.
Let's go to questions. This is George in Colorado's question. In October, my wife and I are going on our dream vacation to Kauai, Hawaii. I'd like to fly one time first class. What is the best way to find nonstop first class flights?
All right. So Krista, what do I say about you can't unsee the front of the plane once you've seen it? I mean, you know, George, I just want you to know, be prepared that if you see it, you experience it, when you take an over-the-water flight, it's going to be hard in the future to not see it again. So just know.
You know what's going on up there the next time you fly.
Yeah, exactly.
Behind the curtain.
Right. So how do you get a cheap deal to the Hawaiian Islands in the front of the plane? It's not going to be cheap, but cheaper. You break the fare. You're in Colorado, not buying a ticket from Colorado all the way to Hawaii in the front of the plane.
So not nonstop like
you asked
for.
Not nonstop. You break the fare in Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Diego, Sacramento, Seattle, whatever, because the flights to Hawaii are competitive from the West Coast. They are not competitive anywhere in the mountain states or back east. So if you do one ticket to the coast, maybe in coach, and then you do a second fare on the same airline so you don't fret about misconnects from the West Coast to Hawaii, you'll likely do better. The best deals on first class from the West Coast to Hawaii are on Alaska, Hawaiian, and they're trying to get married right now. Those two tend to offer better deals on their first class seats, but you're going to have to hunt around different departure points. So, and then you always have Southwest where every seat is first class, well, but not really.
But then your whole thing with like using the same airline, Hawaiian probably doesn't fly from Colorado, but maybe you spend a night on the West Coast, would you
Hawaiian
say?
Doesn't fly out of Denver?
Oh, maybe they do. I just assumed they didn't.
Huh. But. Yeah, so if you do change airlines going from your Colorado departure point, Denver, the Springs, over to the West Coast, give yourself extra buffer time so that you don't miss that flight you paid that big money to fly first class to Hawaii. And if you look around on Hawaiian search engine, they fly to so many West Coast departure points. You look, the first class fares are very different from one flight to another, same route. So you may find that, oh, well, if we go at 3, we'll get a deal. If we go at 1, we won't. That sort of thing. And if you have any points that you can transfer from a credit card, often the cheapest deal on first class from the West Coast to Hawaii is using points for a frequent flyer redemption for the front.
And you also mentioned in our staff meeting the other day that you were reading an article about when's the best time to book, but basically that different
sites
say different things.
So anybody who says with authority, oh, the absolute best day to buy is 68.3 days before your departure for this, that, or the other. There are mathematical formulas. And the one thing that's absolutely true now, you get within 21 days buying a ticket, you're going to get clobbered. And there are certain patterns, but they are not necessarily the databases different people use. They make your eyes glaze over. I think it'd be good at Clark.com if we summarized what, you know, this one says buy a domestic ticket 58 days in advance. This one says no, 70 days in advance. This one says 35, whatever. Just show the confusion and maybe you try all 3 dates and see what's cheapest for your trip.
Set fare alerts on Google Flights, right?
Google Flights and Hopper. I like Hopper a lot to look for fares.
Okay, Scott in Georgia says, whatever happened to couponing? It was all anyone could talk about 10 years ago, but I haven't heard a word about it in a long time. Is this still a good way to save money? And if so, what is the best way to go about it?
Much different than it was 10 years ago because it's now all digitized. And so you have a fight going on also between the retailers and supermarkets. Supermarkets were always the heart of couponing. Between the supermarkets themselves and the product manufacturers, they both cooperate and essentially compete with each other. And so you want to look for electronic coupons at the website of the manufacturers of your favorite items and also at the, particularly with supermarkets, the supermarket chain itself, to see what kind of electronic couponing they offer. The nation's second largest supermarket, Kroger that operates under like 24 different names around the country, they have an incredibly complex app and website you have to use where you have to click on digital coupons when you're at the register, sign into your account, and then in theory, the register will pick up that you clipped the electronic coupon, but you don't know till you finished your purchase and the end of the receipt will show the digital coupons. Do you ever shop at one of the Kroger branded supermarkets? Do you see that?
Not as often, no, but I haven't used the app and I probably should when I do.
I mean, Kroger is a high-low, and this is where the coupons really matter, is high-low retailers that the regular prices on things are very expensive, but when something's on discount, and then in addition to discount being on coupon, the prices are extremely low on those items. So couponing does happen now. It's actually more complicated than it was when you used to have to take the glossy coupon things and cut them out with scissors and turn them into the register. It's more work now than it was before.
You would have been proud of me the other day, by the way.
I'm always proud of you,
Krista.
I was
stereotypically in Target, and I got a 3-pan set, these ceramic pans that I really wanted. Normally $69, and it was $39.99. So I got up to the register, and I paid attention, which I'm not always good at, of what it was ringing up as, and it rang up as the regular price. And I said, no, that's supposed to be on sale. And I went back and took a picture of the sale price and showed it to the cashier. And it turns out they just had failed to take the tag down that the deal was over.
The deal was over.
But she gave me the deal. She was like, I better buy some of these before they take that tag down. Anyway.
So you saved $30.
Yeah.
But then the problem is you have to cook.
Well, I do cook. I do cook.
Cooking.
Saves me a lot of money to cook. Okay, yeah. Joe in Tennessee says, my credit union just mailed me a notice informing me of their decision to adopt binding arbitration. I have 30 days to opt out in writing. In my 20 plus years as a member, I've had nothing but good service from this credit union, but I'm always wary of the wave of binding arbitration that has swept corporate America. What is your opinion on a member-owned credit union adopting this legal standard?
I despise it. I just have this feeling, I have nothing to back it up with, that when they went to their national convention of the credit unions, that almost certainly there was a session about adopting binding arbitration, because this is not an isolation. We've heard this repeatedly over the last year. Credit unions trying to behave like a bank and take away your rights under the U.S. Constitution to a day in court. This is an abusive practice, because binding arbitration imposed by big organizations is always a kangaroo court stacked against a consumer. Why do consumers lose in arbitration over 99% of the time? Because the arbitrators are handpicked by the financial institutions, and they crush the consumer. The arbitrators don't find for the financial institution. The financial institution doesn't hire those arbitrators anymore. It's that simple. And so I hate this. And the good news is the times that somebody has a problem with a credit union, it happens, but it's very rare. Good, you read the notice. If you can take the time, opt out of the arbitration, you'll be like the only person who read anything that came or did anything about it. And then you'll preserve your rights that are so key to why we've shed so much blood over the centuries to preserve our freedoms in the United States. And that the Congress thought it was a great idea to allow kangaroo court justice in the United States and our dealings with corporate America is just disgusting. It's an example of how big corporations call the shots. It's a shame. They give the money and the congressmen march to their drummer. This is just another example, the abuse of consumers through arbitration. If arbitration was done in a way that the forums were fair, it would be different, but they're not. Just think about it. I mean, you'd have to be the old Soviet Union for the defendant to lose 99% of the time or more. But that's what the numbers show in these financial industry arbitrations. And obviously, it's not a fair system. And I want to thank you so much for joining us on today's podcast. Remember what we're about, you learning ways to save more and spend less and avoid getting ripped off.